conference record has joined the conference.
Hi, this is Brenda Gebbards from JPRO Network. Thank you for joining the call and also the webinar. We'll be starting in just 2 minutes. I just wanted to let you know that you are at the right place. So hang in there for 2 more minutes and we'll be starting. You just made it private. Hi everyone, this is Brenda Gebbards, Executive Director of the JPRO Network. We'll start in just 1 minute. Thanks for hanging in for your patience. Okay, I think we're going to start right now. So this is Brenda Gebbards, Executive Director of JPRO Network. We're very pleased to bring you this important webinar and conference call today. We had the elections, now what? Israeli politics, anti-Israel sentiment, and Israel education. It's brought to you by the Program Committee of JPRO. Mark Young and June Gutterman are the co-chairs, and we thank them for their leadership, as well as Emily Wellickson, who is our program coordinator. At this time, I'm going to turn over the call to Mark Young, who is the program coordinator of experiential learning initiatives at the William Davidson Graduate School of Jewish Education at the Jewish Theological Seminary. And Mark, as I mentioned, is co-chair of the JPRO Program Committee and a board member. Mark, thank you, and welcome to all of our participants.
Well, thank you, Brenda. Thank you, Emily, and on behalf of me and June, really excited to bring you this webinar today. Thank you so much for joining this JPRO Network program. JPRO, it's your Jewish Professionals Resource Organization, and it's your professional network. We strive to educate, connect, inspire, and empower all of our Jewish community professionals. So I'm so glad that all of you are here today so we can do just that. World events have had a profound impact on us as professionals in the Jewish community. Today's webinar is the first in a series in which JPRO Network will be exploring the implications of world events on us, Jewish professionals. Today's webinar, we had the elections. Now what? Israeli politics, anti-Israel sentiment, and the Israeli education implications for Jewish community professionals. This is today, and it'll be followed by a program on April 14th with Ira Forman, Special United States Envoy for Monitoring and Combating Anti-Semitism. So we're just getting started. Dr. Sinclair will be responding to questions throughout the webinar. Your phone lines are muted, so to ask questions during the webinar, as Brenda has been sharing with us, type your question in at the bottom of the webinar screen if you're online, or if you're just calling in, email your questions to info@jpro.org. And if you're not using the visual component, if you're just calling in, you can go to the JPRO website, jpro.org, go to jpro.org, upcoming/webinars, and you'll find Alex's PowerPoint. And it's a real pleasure to introduce Alex because I am currently at the Jewish Theological Seminary sharing with you today, and my colleague Alex is in Israel. But we've been able to work together, and I'm really thrilled that he's able to be our educator and facilitator this afternoon. So Dr. Alex Sinclair is joining us from Modi'in in Israel, where he resides. He's a thinker, he's a researcher, he's a practitioner in the field of Israel education. Dr. Sinclair grew up in London, England, and was active for many years on both a lay and professional level in the Masorti, or conservative movement there. He did his undergraduate work in classics and then Hebrew studies at Oxford, and then earned a PhD in Jewish education at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He's published articles in scholarly journals and in more popular formats, and has taught and facilitated teacher education in day school, camp, and synagogue school settings. He's a lecturer in Jewish education at the Schechter Institute of Jewish Studies, Jerusalem, a researcher at Macomb, the Israel Engagement Network of the Jewish Agency, Jerusalem, and an adjunct assistant professor of Jewish education at the William Davidson Graduate School of Jewish Education at Jewish Theological Seminary. JTS, Dr. Sinclair teaches online courses and runs our annual Visions and Voices of Israel seminar, as well as our Kesher Hadash Semester in Israel program. He's also a Tanakh Bible education consultant for the Melton Avichai Jewish Day School Standards and Benchmarks Project. We are definitely talking to the right person today. So Dr. Sinclair, as the title says, we have the elections. Now what? And I'll just remind people to ask questions throughout the webinar. Alex, take it away.
Hi, everybody. Thank you, Mark, for that introduction. I'll just make a quick correction, which is I think that might have been a bio that was a couple of years old. I'm no longer at the Schechter or Macomb, but I'm a full-time employee of JTS here in Israel, where, as Mark said, I run Kesher Chadash, which is the Semester in Israel program for students at the Davidson School. But apart from that, it was all great. And I hope to live up to that introduction. This is a really, I think it's, as Mark said, and as I can already see with the questions coming in, this is, I think it's a really important and timely webinar. When we set it up, we knew it would be right after the elections, but we didn't know what would happen during the elections, obviously. And I think that given what did happen in the elections, I think there's a lot of questions that everybody has that we're really going to address. So let me share with you the plan for today's webinar. I hope that you can all see that, those of you who are online using the webinar system. This is the plan for what we'll do over the next 55 minutes or so. I'm going to start with a very brief review of the election results. This will be very brief because I'm assuming that everyone here or most of you here have been following the news and have a sense of what's going on. But I figure just to level the playing field, we'll spend just a very few minutes looking at what the results actually were. Then I'm going to discuss some of the major questions that have emerged since the election. We're now just under 1 week from, you know, when the elections were, and a lot of stuff has happened in that week. They say a week is a long time in politics. A week is obviously a long time in Israeli politics and in Israel education and in American, the relations between American Jewry and Israel. So a lot's happened in that week, and we're going to raise some of the major questions that have emerged and that are on people's radar screens right now. Then we'll have a segment looking at anti-Israel sentiment and looking at how we grapple with anti-Israel sentiment, especially in the light of both the recent elections and potentially of the things that we might have. Looking especially at the comments, if you can see there in the chat screen that Emily just put up there, which really kind of gets to the heart of that question. And finally, I'll talk about Israel education or implications for Israel education and Israel communal engagement. And I'm aware that many people who have signed on are some of you may be Israel educators in a kind of classic sense, and some of you may be are Jewish educational and communal professionals of all sorts. So I'll try to broaden it to communal engagement with Israel rather than Israel education in a more narrow sense. My plan is that after each segment, each of those four segments, I'll stop. We'll have some time for questions through the online system, and also I hope plenty of time at the end for questions as well. All right, so that's the plan. If anybody has any like burning urgent questions before we start, plug them in. That one that Emily just raised at the start of the question that just came in, I'm concerned that many who feel BD doesn't speak for them may, in the rancor of the times, give up on finding identity as part of the Jewish people. That's going to be a major question that we're going to address. Let's start by looking at the election results. And I'm aware that this slide here is a little difficult to see. It's just a screen a screenshot that I snipped from Haaretz the other day. So it's a little difficult to see. The print is a little small, but I'll go through it anyway, just to give you a sense of what there is. These are the mandates. As you probably know, there are 120 seats in the Knesset. Those 120 seats are distributed proportionately by percentages according to the number of votes that each party gets. So if there are 120 people who happen to vote in the country and 10 vote for Likud, then Likud will get 10 seats. I think the number of votes that you needed in this election for one mandate, one seat, was somewhere between 30,000 and 40,000 votes per seat. There was also a minimum number of votes that each party had to get, a threshold that each party had to get to before getting into the game, before getting any seats at all, and that was 4. So in other words, if you got less than 4 seats, if you got enough votes for 3 seats percentage-wise, you ended up with 0. And you'll see that in a second when I go through the parties. So going from left to right here, as you see it on the screen, that light blue bar is Likud with 30 seats. The next bar across, the kind of turquoisey color, is the Zionist Union or the Zionist camp with 24 seats. The next bar to the right was 13 seats, which was the joint list, which was Chadash and the Arab parties who united together to create a joint Arab list. Next to them, that kind of darker blue color was Yesh Atid, Yair Lapid's party with 11 seats. The yellow one next to that with 10 seats was Kulanu, Moshe Kahlon's party with 10 seats. Then you have Habayit HaYudi, Naftali Bennett's party with 8 seats. Next to that, Shas with 7. United Torah Judaism, or Yahadut HaTorah, the ultra-Orthodox Ashkenazi party with 6 seats. Israel Beitenu, Avigdor Lieberman's party also got 6. And finally, Meretz, the left-wing Zionist party with 5 seats. And Yachad, which was a new party, a right-wing, very, very right-wing party under the leadership of Eli Yishai, formerly of Shas, did not make that electoral threshold, and did not make the Knesset. I'm just seeing a note from Marilyn Grossman that I'm on mute and that you can't unmute it. I'm assuming that everybody else can hear me. Is that correct?
Alex, I can hear you. This is Mark. So we'll okay. Help so
I'm assuming that's a specific problem that Marilyn is having, and Marilyn, maybe just hopefully you can work that out. So those were the results. And if you look at the next slide, this slide is easier to see. This one I did for you guys. This is what it looks like the likely coalition will be. Yes, it looks like everyone can hear me. Okay. So it looks, as of today, this is what it looks like the coalition will be. As you probably know, the president of the State of Israel, President Rivlin, has to appoint the person who he thinks, based on the recommendations of the leaders of the parties, has the most chance of forming a coalition. A coalition obviously has to be more than 60 people mathematically, has to get to that magic number 61. And this is what the coalition looks like right now. It looks like it'll be Likud, it'll be Kulanu, Habayit HaYudi, Shas, Yisrael Beitenu, and Yahadut HaTorah. And if I did the math correctly, that comes to 67, which is a stable coalition, certainly as Israeli governmental coalitions go. It looks like a pretty stable coalition and one that I imagine will last. You know, I hesitate to say the full 4-year term because most Israeli governments tend not to last the full term, but it looks like it's a pretty stable coalition. There was some thought that Yesh Atid might get pulled in, but as of today, that looks pretty unlikely. It looks very unlikely that is going to happen. Of course, things can change. So that's the coalition. It's been characterized as a right-wing nationalistic religious coalition, and that's probably a fair characterization, and that's where we stand right now. So those are just a few very brief remarks on sort of segment one. Does anybody have any kind of major questions about this? I'm guessing this is stuff that you knew already, but I thought it was making sense to put it out there anyway. Anyone have any questions?
Alex, this is Mark. I have the ability of asking a question, audio, and maybe you'll address this a little later. I'm curious to know, because I'm not sure if many of us know the platforms of each of these parties. How mm-hmm. might this drive Likud in a certain direction? I think most of us understand Likud is kind of a center-right party. Is this going to push them potentially farther to the right based on the other parties in this coalition? How do we make sense of kind of the screen?
Yeah, so I'll come to that question. I'll say something about it now, and then I'll move into the next segment where that question will come up, I guess, in more detail. Yeah, Likud is seen as a center-right party. Broadly speaking, of that list there, Habayit HaYehudi, the Jewish Home Party, is seen to be a party that's further to the right. Yisrael Beiteinu also is seen as further to the right, although Yisrael Beiteinu is more complicated in certain ways. Kulanu is seen as a more centrist party. Moshe Kachlon, the head of Kulanu, was a member of the Likud until about 2 years ago. When he broke off to first take a break from politics and then form his own party. And Kulanu is seen as a more centrist party with a focus on social and economic issues and not so much on issues of security and territory. Shas is a religiously, let's say, right-wing or traditionalist or it's a Sephardi Orthodox or ultra-Orthodox party, but in many other ways, socially, economically, and also, at least historically, it's been sometimes in security and territory realms, it has had more centrist platforms. So it's hard to tell, but my sense is, and again, the caveat is I'm not a political commentator. I'm an Israel educator. So for real political commentary, you need to go to those who do that for a living. But my sense is that Likud will be a main driver in this coalition. They did get they're clearly the major partner in the coalition, and Netanyahu himself, I think, has come out of the elections with a clear mandate. So I'm going to move on, and some of these questions will stay with us. So here, I think, are the major questions that have emerged from election day itself, and certainly and in the week after the election. And I'm going to say a few things about each of these questions. So the first area is the relationship between America and Israel, and I think there's two parts of that which you all have been really thinking about these, and your colleagues and communities and friends have been, I'm sure, talking about these, and if you've been reading the Jewish press and the Israeli press, these have been very much spoken about. First of all, Netanyahu explicitly rejected the two-state solution, or at least was perceived as rejecting the two-state solution in some remarks he made shortly before the elections, a few days before the elections, where in an interview he said, "Well, if I'm re-elected under my leadership, there will be no Palestinian state, there will be no two-state solution." Now he has, since the election, he has tried to pedal back on that a bit, and he's given a couple of interviews on American TV where he's claimed that that's not what he said, and that he still holds by his Bar-Ilan speech of 2009. But it certainly seems to me, at least from where I sit, that the perception in the world, in American Jewry, and in Israel as well, is that what he said leading up to the election was kind of the truth, and really kind of got to the core of really what he feels, and that these other remarks are, he's trying to pedal back on that, is being perceived at least as spin or as damage control, and certainly it's kind of created a sense of, and you've heard this from President Obama and from other sort of senior American officials, a sense of a questioning of Netanyahu's trustworthiness and what did he really think, et cetera. And so there are some real reverberations around this perceived rejection of the two-state solution. And I think that's going to be a major theme in American-Israel relations over the coming period of time. I see there's questions coming in. I'll finish up this bit, and then I'll have a look at what those texts text messages just then. The other part of the thing that happens on election day, which I think is also having enormous reverberations for the American-Israel relationship, is that remark that Netanyahu said on election morning, sometime during mid-morning, where he said the government is in danger, the right-wing government is in danger, Arabs are being bussed in droves, bekamu yot, he said in Hebrew, in droves, being translated en masse or in droves or by the busload, this kind of Arabs in droves comment has, I think, really raised a red flag for all kinds of people, both in Israel and abroad. And I don't think Netanyahu is going to live that down. I think that is going to be a comment that is going to be remembered and is going to be continually, referred back to. And it's going to be a major issue, I think. The worst part of all of this is that it worked. In other words, it wasn't just that Netanyahu, and maybe this is a response now to the question that Emily just posted about flip-flopping. Yes, everyone does flip-flop. This is a pretty major flip-flop. But it's not just to be flip-flopped, I think. It's that his flip-flop, his disavowal of the two-state solution and his comments about Arabs being, Arabs coming in droves to the elections, those worked. Those really did bring back a lot of Likud voters to him and seemed to speak to people, to Israelis who voted for him. And so it's not just that he did it, it's the fact that it worked, and it was a successful tactic for him. In other words, that it's not just, it doesn't just speak to Netanyahu and speak to his, flip-flopping or his, qualities as a leader. There's something in there, I think this is how it's been interpreted, that actually is like, it's given a kind of window into how many Israelis feel, or at least Israelis who voted for him. And I think there's going to be major reverberations around that. Okay, so that's kind of one set of questions. Secondly, and maybe on the flip side, some people have been asking the question, did the left really lose so badly? There was an interesting piece by a guy called Noah Ephron, who is an interesting, commentator. He's the host of the Promised podcast. If any of you listen to that, I highly recommend it. And he had a piece where he argued that actually, if you do the math, the left didn't lose so badly. Really, what this election resulted in was an ever so slight move to the left. If you count up the kind of the parties who are broadly speaking right and broadly speaking left and broadly speaking centre, you see a slight movement from the right to the centre and from the centre and the left, and it's resulted in a strong right wing coalition because of Netanyahu's because the Likud got more seats and is able to lead that coalition. But actually, according to maths, maybe the electorate moved a little bit to the left. Now, that's an interesting question. I think many people on the, if you read things that people on the left are saying, I don't think that's a common motive. I think many people on the left in Israel are feeling that they did lose. But certainly, it's worth pausing and thinking about it and looking at the maths and looking at the results a little bit more carefully and saying, well, maybe that's a psychological feeling, and maybe if you look at the numbers objectively, the left didn't lose so badly. So that's kind of an interesting thing to think about. The third, I think, really major question, and this really is about the future of the left in Israel, and I've put these in this third bullet point. I did ask two questions here, which, even though they seem separate and they seem almost contradictory, I think really they're part of the same question, and that's the puzzle that the left has to crack. So one is, can the left create let me do the second question first. Can the left reach out to new Jewish constituencies beyond its base? One of the things that became very clear very soon after the election results came out or became clear was that the left had invigorated its base, but had utterly failed to speak to vast swathes of the country. And that most centre and right wing voters were not in any way persuaded by the arguments of the left, and the left really is spoke to its bubble. It preached to the converted and didn't manage to get out of its base. And one of the challenges for the left in Israel right now is can it really can it speak to Israelis beyond quote unquote the Tel Aviv bubble or beyond those people who have typically voted to the left? Can it speak to centrist voters in the south and in the north? Can it speak to Mizrahi voters who have typically not voted left? Can it create wider constituencies in amongst the Jewish populations of the country, which might bring it back to power? And that's a major question that the left is facing right now in Israel. The second, I think, very, very interesting question is there's this, as I mentioned before, the when we went over the results, the Arab List, the Joint Arab List, is now the third largest party in the Knesset with 13 seats, and potentially a major player in Knesset. And one question is, can the left build some kind of Zionist Arab alliance? Can the left function as a left in the Knesset, as an alliance between Zionists and Arabs, and between Jewish left-wing parties and Arab left-wing parties? Is there anywhere at all to kind of create a narrative, a Zionist left-wing narrative, which will be palatable to large numbers of Jewish Israelis who might be inclined to vote left for all kinds of social or economic and also security reasons, and can also in some way include that large block now of Arab voters? That I think is a major question, not just politically for Israel, but also sociologically for Israel. I think one of Israel's major sociological challenges in the coming, I would say, decade is to create some kind of common narrative that can be palatable and can speak to both Jewish Israelis and Arab Israelis or Palestinian Israelis, Palestinian citizens of Israel. And that's a major sociological challenge that Israel faces. And the head of the Arab List, a guy called Ayman Odeh, is apparently, by all accounts, a very interesting and very thoughtful politician. And there may be all kinds of interesting things happening as we go forward. So that's just something to look out for, something to think about. Certainly, President Rivlin sees this as a major goal for his presidency. He's although Rivlin comes from the Likud, comes from the right wing, he's very, very committed to equal rights for all Israeli citizens. He's a Jabotinskian, I think a true Jabotinskian Zionist, for those who might want to think about it in that way. And so this will be really interesting, those two questions about the future of the left in Israel. Okay, finally, and this is really the topic of the core topic of what we're talking about today, is liberal American Jews. And here's the million-dollar question. Will this result lead to increased alienation, increased apathy, or increased activism? And that's really a major question which we're going to be thinking about today. So I'm going to pause now just for a minute or two. I'm going to look at some of the questions. If anybody wants to post in more questions, I'm going to read out some of these questions here. Marilyn Grossman, in today's Al Monitor briefing, the lead article says the setup of the new coalition, no opening for a renewed diplomatic process leading into Israel into international isolation. You know, does that seem to be the case, and can Kulanu mitigate this at all? It's a great question. Again, I'll give the caveat. I'm not a political analyst, and I really want to get to the questions of education and communal engagement. It's a great question. I think that the question is, the problem is that Kulanu's platform was a social economic platform and did not really talk about security or territorial issues at all. And I think that really what Moshe Kachlon, the head of Kulanu, wants to do is to create radical change in Israel's economic and social policies. That's what he was elected for. And so he may be of the view that that's what he needs to focus on, and he needs to answer to his voters who I think really did vote for him for that reason. So I don't know. I mean, the question of Israel's international isolation is a major question. I'm now looking at David Greenstein's question from Montclair. Hi, Montclair. I used to live in Caldwell, New Jersey, so just around the corner from Montclair. The real question for me as an Israel educator is, what values does the present Israeli leadership reflecting a solid majority of the Israeli public believe in, and do those values fit what I believe as a dream? We're going to come to that absolutely right now. yeah, we're going to, that's very much the question that we're going to come to when it comes to Israel education. And so I think with that, I'm going to move on, unless there are any other questions that emerged just now. Emily, do you have anything else? Or Mark, do you have anything else that's coming by email?
Let's move on to the next phase, and then we'll continue to collect questions.
Yeah.
This is great.
Yeah. Okay, so a few thoughts now about dealing with anti-Israel sentiment. We're now in the third segment of what I wanted to do, and I'll spend a little bit of time on this. And David's question is really the one I want to get to in the fourth segment. Here's some examples of anti-Israel sentiment. And these are the kind of things which we, I think, have heard in all kinds of contexts, on campus and in various other contexts over the past few years. And I think that we've heard them especially since the election. And I think that we're going to hear these kinds of things more and more. On the next slide, I hope this next slide might be clear. This is my analysis of what I think is going on with many people in the American Jewish community, where if you take take any one of those, I'll go back. If you take any one of these statements, and some of them I guess are more controversial than others, but I think if you take any one of them, most, and there'll be a lot of generalizations in what I'm about to say now, and again, you guys are there on the ground, and you guys will tell me if I'm right or wrong. But I think in previous years, most American Jews, or many American Jews, were on the left-hand side of this slide. And you might say that some part of me agrees with some part of what some anti-Israel people are saying. If you take things like, let's take a non-controversial one like Israel, let's say that middle one, Israel continues to build settlements in violation of international law. That's a kind of a classic piece of anti-Israel sentiment that has been said over the past many years. So I think that many American Jews might have fallen with regard to that statement in that left-hand column. And I think that what's been happening over the past few years, and I think especially there's been a kind of acute acceleration of it, I think, over the past week since the elections, is that American Jewish opinion is moving rightwards in this graph, not rightwards politically, obviously, but rightwards in terms of the graphic that you see in front of you. So that if people were saying, that very, very equivocal, some party individuals, some part of what some, but now you might hear more people saying, well, I totally agree with some part of what some anti-Israel people are saying. And you can also kind of put that totally, you can mix, there's one totally and two sums there, so you can mix that around as well. And then maybe even moving into, I totally agree with everything that some anti-Israel people are saying. I think that that's one of the kind of I think a lot of the kind of the angst that I'm seeing going on in Facebook discussions and op-eds by people in the American Jewish community over the past week is that kind of angst about the realization that either they or their friends or colleagues or congregants have suddenly jumped into that third column and suddenly people are over there in that third column and that some of those statements about, well, especially let's say, for example, Israel, many Israelis being racist, that whole, Arabs in droves comment by Prime Minister Netanyahu has really, I think, pushed maybe people into that third column, with regard to that. And, I don't think that many American Jews are in that fourth column yet. There probably are some, American Jews, involved in very left-wing, organizations who probably would be in that fourth column, but I don't think that we're there yet. I don't think many people are there yet, but I do think that from my sense is that there's this kind of movement into that second and third column. And so the question is, what do you do? How do you deal with anti-Israel sentiment when you would say that I actually agree with some parts of what some anti-Israel people are saying, or I agree with everything that some anti-Israel people are saying, or I agree with some part of what many anti-Israel people, that middle ground there, that very equivocal or conflicted middle ground there, is I think a place where more and more American Jews are in, and how do you respond to anti-Israel sentiment when you're in that middle ground? I'm just looking at the question that David Greenstein asked again. I'm not sure I understand the question. So I'll come back then a second. Let me give you this other slide, and then I'll pause with this segment here, and then I'll respond to those questions, and then we'll get the final piece, which is about Israel education and Israel engagement. So here's what I would suggest as a thumbnail picture of how we need to deal with anti-Israel sentiment. I think in the distant past we dealt with anti-Israel sentiment by using phrases like myths and facts. And there was even a very famous, or a pretty famous, quite well-known book that came out, I think, 20 or 30 years ago, I can't remember exactly, that was called Myths and Facts, which was, you know, this is what they say and this is what you say. These are the myths that they will tell you and these are the facts that you say in return. A kind of very advocacy-oriented approach to deal with anti-Israel sentiment. I think those days have been gone for a while now. And I think in the recent past, we could say things like the full picture is much more complicated. If somebody was to say, well, Israelis are racist, or the settlements are a problem, or these kind of things, we would say things like the full picture is much more complicated, and try to kind of flesh it out and give context I'm calling it apologetics, which is probably not a very fair characterization. The truth is I was just looking for another A. Because I came up with advocacy and activism, I was just looking for another word that began with A to go in the middle there. But it's a more complicated, conflicted, equivocal kind of response. I'm going to claim, and now I'm coming to maybe some more of the kind of radical claims that I might make, that I'm really happy to have a discussion about, both now and continuing, is that I think that neither of these two options is viable today. I think that we actually today need an approach characterized by activism, and this will be a segue into how I want to now characterize Israel education and communal Israel engagement in these times, which is that if people feel that they're disagreeing with Israeli government policy, or they're feeling, as one of the comments said earlier, that Israel's policies don't match with their Jewish sentiments or their moral compass, then what we need is an activist sense of Israel education and activist engagement with Israel, which is to say, if you don't like something, try to do something about it. Try to work with Israelis, try to work with others, and try to change things. And this is what that activist perspective looks like, you know, when you're actually in a conversation with somebody who's critical of Israel. And here I would say I'm not talking about a conversation with, you know, an Islamic fundamentalist on campus who rejects Israel's right to exist. I think that I'm talking about a conversation with a non-Jewish friend, a non-Jewish co-worker, somebody who you meet in any kind of other context where there's a difficult but civil conversation going on, where somebody is really being critical of Israel, and the move that I would make would be to say that first of all, some or even much of what you're saying is right, so I agree with what you're saying. If somebody's giving certain certain sentiments that are critical, let's say, maybe that's what David was saying before, maybe not using the phrase anti, but critical of Israel, to say, yeah, I agree with some of what you're saying. And the second point, crucially, many Israelis agree with you and with me on that point. In other words, a second move is cracking open the idea of Israel as a monolithic entity where all Israelis think the same thing. It's really trying to kind of to open up the idea that Israel is a very diverse society with very great disagreements between different sectors of the population, and to say that many Israelis would agree with that issue that you've just raised. And then this is the activist piece: how can we work together to strengthen those Israeli constituencies and communities who are working towards a more just and Jewish situation in Israel as we would see it? So it's a demand for cooperation, a demand for collaboration, a demand for action, and a demand for activism. And I think that's the way that we have to reframe anti-Israel or sentiment that's critical of Israel whether it's on campus, whether it's in business frameworks, whether it's in professional frameworks. It's about it's not about advocacy. It's not about apologetics. It's about activism and saying, yeah, I also agree there's a problem, and I'm a Jew who's committed to Israel and has a strong relationship with Israel, but I'm agreeing with you this is a problem, and let's talk about how we together can try to help Israelis who are working also to fix this problem. So that is the end of this third segment, and what I want to do now is I want to go back now down to the bottom of the screen here, and let me try to kind of pull together some of the questions that people have.
Alex, this is Mark.
Sure.
I want to help you with that, because a few questions have just come in.
Okay.
One from Michael Rassler of, what are the implications for us as Jewish communal professionals, which I think speaks a little bit, maybe not directly, to David Greenstein's second point of, what if we do some of the strategies that you're saying and are thus labeled anti-Israel? Is there a way to effectively respond to that?
I missed the question. Say it again.
So I think what David Greenstein, I think is what he's saying is, what if we do these strategies that you're suggesting, and then you then become labeled, or the strategies become labeled anti-Israel within powerful sectors or institutions of our community? What might be the response then?
Yeah. That is a nice segue into the fourth segment where I'm really going to talk about this. But I'll just say a brief response to that. I think you've got to really, really stand strong on that piece that I said just now in terms of those three things, which is that I'm saying this as a proud Jew, as a proud Zionist who's deeply committed to Israel, has a strong relationship with Israel. I think we have to reclaim that position and stand strong for that position. I understand it's becoming a complicated and controversial position to stand for. And, you know, just today for example, the stuff about Hillel, and there's 100 other examples as well. I think more and more American Jews who are feeling this kind of tension are becoming more ready to make that stand and say, I'm saying this as a proud Jew with a strong relationship with Israel, but I'm willing to say that I agree with some of the critique of Israel, or much of the critique of Israel on particular issues, and I want to try to, rather than argue against it, I want to work with Israelis to fix it together. I think that's the other crucial part of that, is about building alliances with Israelis and creating alliances between American Jews and Israelis whose voices feel connected to each other. And then I think that takes away some of the steam from people who too easily push people into the critical of Israel camp. And I appreciate that as David, you're saying that we do these strategies, that's the reality we face. Let me come to the fourth segment and this will maybe we'll flesh out some of these questions. BDSR, I'll come to it. I see the question from Ted from St. Paul and I'll the question about BDS, and I'll come to that maybe at the end. But let me move on and talk a little bit about Israel engagement. And first of all, I'll do this really quickly, but I couldn't resist. I'll just do a quick plug for my book. I wrote a book a year and a half or so ago dealing with many of these issues. It's called Loving the Real Israel, an Educational Agenda for Liberal Zionism. These are some of the questions on the right that I deal with in the book. Can engagement with the real Israel and with all of Israel's complexities and difficulties, can that lead to a robust and committed relationship with Israel? What do we mean by love when we talk about loving Israel? What do we actually mean by that? Is there a place, and what's the place of anger and frustration in a relationship with Israel? And I think that's very much a question that's come up in the past week. So if anybody's interested, you can go to tinyurl.com/realisrael. That will take you to the Amazon page for it. And it makes a great gift for a Pesach Seder or for Yom HaTzmaut. If you buy one for every member of your Pesach family. Anyway, so I wanted to say that. And I'll briefly say a few words about Kesher Chadash, the program that I run, that Mark mentioned at the beginning when he introduced me. This is a program that's part of the MA in Jewish Education at JTS, where we train young emerging Jewish educators, people who are doing an MA in Jewish education. We train them to do Israel education in this way, to think about transforming the field of Israel education through a sophisticated love of Israel that's nurtured through immersion and deep understanding of Israel's complexities and nuances, and all of these kind of these questions that we've been talking about today are the questions that we work on in Kesher Chadash. I've given there some a couple of academic articles, a couple of research articles that we've published about it in the Journal of Jewish Education, and a couple of pieces in E-Jewish Philanthropy. The slides available, as was said earlier, on the JPRO website, or will be available, and feel free to look at those. Okay, enough of that. But these are the educational questions that's raised. Questions like, which story do we tell? This is, what's the story of Israel that we tell? Do we tell the story of Israel? Look, in the old days, we would say, do we tell the story of Jaffa oranges and the kibbutz and the Kova Tembel? And that was kind of the beautiful, mythic Israel. Today, that's been replaced by, the Israel of the startup nation and the USB stick and high tech and the beaches and the parties and that kind of, is that the story of Israel we tell? Do we tell the story that the harder stories of Israel, the harder parts of the story of Israel, the stuff that's come up today, the stuff that gets at difficult questions like racism and difficult questions like tribalism and difficult questions these kinds of things. So that's a major educational question. What's the story of the narrative of Israel that we tell? And related to that is that second question. When, where, and how do we introduce the less attractive stuff? If we want to be authentic to the subject matter, if we want to teach the full Israel, if we want to teach the full picture of Israel, all of Israel's complexities and nuances and difficulties, then maybe we do need to learn. But at what age do we start to tell kids that things are complicated, things are not so simple? Does one story come first and the other later? Do we start by telling kids all of the beautiful stuff about Israel, and only when they get to a certain age do we start telling them, well, actually things are a little bit more complicated than that? Of course, the big question there is, well, what's that age? Is it 18, 16, 13, 12, 8, 6? Can you integrate them? And my approach, I'll put my cards on the table, is that I do believe in an integrationist approach to these questions. I think you can integrate these questions and you can teach about Israel in a way that is at the same time exciting and inspiring and compelling, and at the same time grappling with Israel's flaws and failures and difficulties and challenges and frustrations. And you can do that, I think, at any age in a developmentally appropriate fashion. But those are some of the educational questions that we have to grapple with when it comes to teaching Israel. And then there are communal issues as well. And, I don't need to tell you about these kinds of things. These are some of the things that have come up in the past, few years. Open Hillel, I just said something about that before, and then that's just come up into the news just in the past day or two with a Swarthmore Hillel and that news. J-Street and the Federation, that was an issue. I'm losing track of time now. Was that a year ago or 2 years ago? I'm losing track of time, but also recently. The role of the American Jewish community in religious pluralism issues in Israeli society, which has traditionally been a major, major issue and a major kind of problem for liberal American Jews, hasn't been on the radar screen at all over in this election cycle, and even now isn't at all. But questions like the place of egalitarian minyanim at the Kotel, and the role of a conservative and reform rabbis in Israeli society, and conversion, and all of these kinds of things, which periodically rear their head and also become a major kind of barrier for that sort of pure pro-Israel, if you like, engagement. Well, one of the major questions, I think, one of the major challenges for Israel engagement is the reticence of rabbis to talk about Israel from the pulpit. There was some research that Steve Cohen and Jason Gitlin did a couple of years ago, where they showed that a significant number of rabbis just won't talk about Israel from the pulpit. It's the third rail of pulpit life or synagogue life, because they know that whatever they say, if they say anything to the left, then the right-wing person on their board will have it in. And if they say anything to the right, then the left-wing person on their board will have it in. So it's much easier not to touch Israel at all and to talk about other things as well. Now, for somebody who's like me, who's really, really interested in having Israel be part of and a major part of the American Jewish conversation and part of American Jewish identity, if rabbis are not talking about Israel at all from the pulpit, that's a major problem. And we really have to deal with that and figure out a way to improve the conversation about Israel in communities. And the tension between Israel advocacy and Israel education is something that I spoke a little bit about already. I won't say anything more about that now. Here's the last slide of the presentation, and then I'll come to many of the questions. We have a little bit of time for some discussion. What does this mean for Israel education and Israel communal life? The first thing I want to say is that it demands of us a willingness to what I would call open the black box and really have all of us engage with a deep and complex and, yes, sometimes troubling issues in Israeli society. We have to really like that there's nothing that's out of bounds. There's nothing that has to be kind of put behind whitewashed or put behind a glass somewhere. But we really have to kind of grapple with it and get our hands dirty with everything about what's going on in Israeli society. Many of you, I'm sure, will have a problem with the second bullet point, and we can talk about it. But I think we have to kind of not worry or stop worry or worry less about how this will look or how it will affect Israel advocacy or will it give succor to the anti-Zionists. You know, there is a complicated political conversation going on, and it will get very, very difficult. I think I foresee, as I said earlier, very, very troubling times ahead for the relationship between American Jews in Israel and the American administration in Israel, I think, as well. But I think that educationally, we have to be prepared to dive into it and to allow our students and our congregants and our colleagues to really grapple with these questions freely. Because anytime anybody says, well, we're not allowed to say that, or we're not allowed to touch that, or we're not allowed to do that, that's a very miseducative move. John Dewey famously defined education as something which will lead to further growth and development. And when we cut off things, when we say that certain topics or certain issues are forbidden, that's a miseducative move, as Dewey would say. Ultimately, it means having faith. And I really believe in this very, very strongly. I think we have to have faith in the subject matter. You have to have faith in Israel. And that's a really important statement for me to make. And I say this as somebody who's deeply troubled by the current Israeli... what's happened there? Why have we gone back? I don't know why that happened. Deeply troubled by the current Israeli administration, deeply troubled by all kinds of manifestations and policies. But I think you have to have faith. You have to have faith that honest, serious engagement with compelling, open-ended issues will ultimately result in a more robust and vibrant relationship with Israel. Israel is an amazing, incredible, complicated, crazy experiment that the Jewish people are doing along with other people in the 20th and 21st centuries. You have to have faith that real engagement with that subject matter will lead to a robust relationship with it. And finally, I would say that it means seeing Israel education as an activist endeavor, as I said before, that the role of American Jews as Israeli chevrutot in an ideological conversation about Israel's future direction. And when you're in a chevruta, you have machloket l'shem shemayim. And we have to stop being afraid of machloket l'shem shemayim in our conversations about Israel. Machloket l'shem shemayim is a powerful, compelling, ancient Jewish value, which we still have in our study of Torah, and we still have in our relationship to tefillah, and we still have in our relationships, different relationships to halacha. And we need to bring machloket l'shem shemayim back into the Israel conversation. It's okay for us to disagree. It's okay for American Jews and Israeli Jews to disagree, and even to disagree strongly and vociferously, because we can be chevrutot. And being a chevruta doesn't mean agreeing with your chevruta, it means disagreeing with your chevruta. We sometimes are beginning to pull, the biggest danger that we face is apathy. And rather than apathy, I think we need to try to encourage American Jews to get into exciting activist conversations with Israelis about those future directions of Israeli society. So that's what I wanted to say. I'll pause now. We have a few minutes left for some comments and questions. I'm looking here now at what Marilyn said. I'll read it out. I don't know if everyone can see it. My concern is that young people who have never seen Israel as the underdog and are very influenced by what they hear in the news and are not learning anything positive from their parents in school, how do we counter that? Birthright, I won't talk about books like about if it, so far I don't think it has been an impact on birthright. Right, how do you prepare the younger generation to be able to address these issues objectively? Here, I'll respond to that by being a little technical in terms of education. There's an approach to education called project-based learning or problem-based learning (PBL), where people try to construct education as based on issues, problems, challenges which you give to students and their challenges to try to solve or to come to find solutions to these problems. There's a whole world of educational research on this approach to education. It's done in math, it's done in social studies, it's done in science. And I think you can transfer that into Israel education as well, even at very young ages, to say, you know, even in the early grades, to say you can raise questions about Israel as a Jewish state, which also has non-Jewish citizens in it, and how do you kind of how do you enable those people to live together? You can raise questions about equality. You can raise questions all kinds of questions, framing them as PBL, as problem-based learning, and that I think is an educational approach that we can really use in Israel education. I'm looking at a question from Eli. Hi, Eli. Eli Bass is one of my former students and my star students, and he's now in Rochester. I hope it's okay for me to say that. He's written a question. The four sons or four children of the Pesach Haggadah talk about how to ask questions to different learners. I've struggled with the context of the conversation with students who don't know what to ask or where to start the conversation, who have no Israel experience or knowledge. It's a great question. I think very, very briefly, I think one way to get into this question is to use modern Israeli art and music and cultural artifacts. I think there's so much fascinating stuff going on in Israeli society today which does deal with these issues. It deals with all of the tough issues. All of the stuff that we're talking about, but using art as a window into that. So playing somebody a song by Hadad Nachash or a couple of different songs by two different artists that are getting at the same issue. You can really get people into the issues, even people with very little Israel experience, but getting into that through Israeli cultural artifacts, I think, is a really important pedagogic technique. Other questions, Mark or Emily, any other questions that are coming by email? So we only have a few minutes left.
Yeah, I think we have time for one more question. How about we do the one from Hinda Labovitz and Chevy Chase? I'll read it, and then we'll close after that. Not sure whether you saw it before. Even using problem-based learning, the messaging my students are frequently getting from their parents is, quote, I don't live there, so I don't have a right to have an opinion, unquote. How do we combat that?
Yeah. Okay, first of all, hi, Hinda. Hinda's not one of my former students, but Hinda is a, when I said that I lived in Caldwell, New Jersey, and we were very close with Hinda and Hinda's family. So hi, Hinda. Give my love to your parents, and to your brother and sister. It's a great question, and I think it it's a nice place for me to finish. I've written about this in the book, actually, so it goes back to plug the book. I have a whole section in the book where I talk about this, so I'll very briefly give a response to it now. I think this is one of the most problematic positions that we have to counter as Israel educators and as Israel communal people who are interested in communal engagement with Israel, this idea that I don't have a right to an opinion. You know, and we hear it a lot. We hear it from American Jews and from Israelis. You know, you don't live here, you don't serve in the army, you don't pay taxes here, you don't know what it's like. So you know what? You don't have a right to opinion. I think it's a terribly, terribly destructive, educational and communal and strategic statement. And I would very briefly offer the following analogy to help us to help us get around it. If I'm having a problem in my life, in a relationship, in an issue at school, an issue at work, and then often I might actually go to talk to a friend about the problem, or if it's a more serious problem, I might go to a professional to talk about a problem. And if that friend or that professional was to give me some advice or to say something, I wouldn't say, "How dare you give me that advice? You don't live in my shoes. You don't live in my family. You don't understand what it's like to me. How dare you give me that advice?" No, we understand that other people, even if they're not me, even if they're not, they don't live in my shoes, in my life, we understand that we can gain something from an outsider's perspective. We can gain something from a caring, supportive outsider's perspective, somebody who cares about us, but somebody who sees things maybe from a different angle. In our personal lives, we have no problem understanding that that friends who give us advice don't really know what it's like to be us, to be in our heads, but we're really willing to listen to advice from friends from that kind of caring outsider's perspective. That is an analogy that I would use for this, that both you have to persuade American Jews and Israelis that it's okay for American Jews to do that American Jews, and especially liberal American Jews, who have problems with the current administration, that you can care about Israel, you can see things maybe slightly differently, and offering up different ways to think about it. You do have a right to an opinion, and we have to try to persuade through discussion, through encounters, through carefully constructed relationship building with Israelis of all sorts. We have to persuade Israelis to join us in that chevruta, to join American Jews in that chevruta. And if there's one thing that I would finish with, it's that idea that American Jews and Israelis are different. We're different, and this election just shows just how different we are, or just how different many of us are from each other. That's okay. We have to kind of admit to that. We have to own that. And we have to say that a chevruta is really interesting and more interesting when it's two different people who are really struggling with where to take this forward. So it's not an easy task. I believe that's the task that faces us today.
Well, Alex, this is Mark Young again. I have to thank you on behalf of JPRO Network for such an enlightening conversation that's really just the beginning. An hour doesn't do it justice, but hopefully even in this short time, for those that joined us or those that will listen on recording later, will be a little more armed with information and strategies as they go back into their roles as Jewish educators and professionals. What struck me is that the idea of not being apologetic, not being advocates, but just being activists in the conversation, that we can do something that is both just and Jewish for Israel, and that we talk about it. It's better to talk about it and have honest, open conversations. Certainly I've learned from you that directly over the last many years, and thank you for sharing it with our community. I want to thank Dr. Sinclair again and let everyone know that we'll be sending you a very brief one-minute evaluation after this. It will help us going forward. We always want to make these webinars and all of our educational programming relevant, engaging, and helpful to you as Jewish professionals. Remember to save the date, April 14th, 3 p.m., right after Pesach, for our next program with Ira Forman, focusing in particular on European anti-Semitism, something that's been unfortunately very active over the past year. Thank you again to Dr. Sinclair. Thank you to Brenda and Emily at JPRO for all that you do, and wishing everyone in just a couple of weeks, Aziz and Pesach, a happy Passover.
Chag Sameach, everybody. Thanks.
Chag Sameach.
It's finished officially, but I'm still here. If anyone wants to talk to me after class, then I'm happy to hang out.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And then Emily, let us know when you.
Everyone,
let us know when you end the recording, just if we want to say a couple of things post.
Just say quick hi to Michelle.
We had a few. We had Ali Khan was on.
I saw. I just noticed. I just noticed in the middle. I just noticed that she was on there. Yeah, she's still on. Hi, Ali. If you can hear me.
Oprah was on.
Oh, I didn't notice Oprah. Yeah.
I mentioned that we'd be working together just now. So.
Yeah. That's nice.